Cape Talk, Pippa's Planet.
Pippa's Planet, and it's a double header today. I'm going to be chatting to the SciCAD Society, so if you have any questions, join the conversation on that number, 021-446-0567. And then a little later, I'm going to be talking to Peter Flower, the city's water and sanitation director, about the impact that level 6 water restrictions are going to have on Cape Town's pipe infrastructure. And if there are leaks in your home or in your street, how to find them and what you need to do. But let's start with the SciCAD Society, because with the environmental spotlight so focused on the poaching of large animals like rhino or elephant or lions, we forget about the smaller, less compelling species that are also open to attack. Because did you know, and I find this remarkable, that cycads, which are trees that have been grounded in our soil for thousands and thousands of years, are being pulled out of the ground and illegally traded for huge amounts in the landscaping industry, apparently. Well, Fadi Enderman is the secretary of the SciCAD Society. He joins me in the studio to talk about this very unique tree. Fadi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having us. It's good to be able to promote these plants and also the issues that are surrounding them. You're quite correct that cycads are endangered, and especially in a South African context, we've got about 39 species endemic to South Africa, and of those, 11 are critically endangered and 4 are endangered. And then if you look at the IUCN's, call it, levels of endangeredness, there's a lot of them that are near threatened as well. And these are because they are feature plants in gardens. And some people have this perception that they grow very slowly. Some of them actually grow quite fast. And therefore, people would rather have a large poached plant than to go the route of buying a cultivated plant, which is unfortunate because there's a lot of options for indigenous species, but then there's over 350 species at a global level that you could have in your garden which aren't going to necessarily impact the environment. So there are, call it, legal avenues for you to acquire cycads and not be purchasing poached plants.
So what's happening and how is it being monitored?
Well, look, all indigenous cycad species in South Africa are permitted. So so that's managed by the provincial conservation bodies and by the National Department of Environmental Affairs, and there's legislation. So if you want to keep a South African cycad, you've got to have a permit to keep it, and if you need to transport it, you've got to have a permit to transport those plants individually.
And that's not happening.
No, it is happening. But then there are also people that are removing cycads illegally. What you've got to understand as well is that the legislation evolves. So for you to, 20, 30 years ago, you could have bought a seedling plant and you got a receipt for it, and that you were within the law. And you just left that plant and it grew to something that's a meter or 2 meters high. And now you want to sell it, or you're downscaling your garden, or you're downscaling your lifestyle. You want to move into a lock-up-and-go house, and now you're sitting with a plant and you don't have paperwork for it. But you legally got hold of that plant originally. So we've got a project now which we call the Finks Garden or SciCAD Garden, which we're doing in conjunction with the Finks Greenbelt Association and the City of Cape Town, where we're basically taking in some of these, call it, orphan cycads. And what's quite interesting is we've got about 140 of these trees now of various sizes within the broader garden. The garden's got about 500 indigenous trees in it. It's in Bellville. It's on the corner of Yip de Jager and I'll get back to the other road just now. But what's interesting with our water crisis in Cape Town, we bought these plants, some of them we bought, some of them were donated, and the bulk of them went in about 2 years ago onto the site. and they went throughout this last summer, which was quite hot. We didn't irrigate those plants once. Not once. So cycads are very water efficient and water sparing plants to have in your garden.
Are the numbers dwindling? I mean, yes, is there a fight to keep the numbers up?
And in the look, what you might find is that something might be endangered in the wild and quite rare, and yet in cultivation at various size classes, they are quite common. So I'll give you an example. There's the holy grail of cycads in South Africa is a species which is called Encephalatus woody. There's no more plants in the wild. There originally was one plant with five stems in the Ngoya forest in KZN. But there are 3,000 plants in cultivation. So they came from and what's interesting with woody specifically is that these plants, they are only male plants. Only male plants. So these plants, all the 3,000 that we have today are from removing suckers from the original plant and removing suckers from those plants, from the suckered offspring. There are plants that are endangered. Also, you've got to realize that on a planetary scale, extinction is a part of life, just as new species evolve over time. The problem with a lot of this stuff isn't just about poaching. It's also about habitat destruction. So you have overgrazing. You have situations where, for instance, cycads, or at least African cycads, they've got a relationship with beetles and so forth, and these beetles transfer pollen from the male plants to the female plants. There are certain populations of cycads in parts of Africa where there are lots of adult plants, but there's no recruitment of juvenile plants because the beetles that are in association with that have died out. So the pollinator no longer exists. So you have huge stands of adult populations. A good example is a species from Uganda, which is called Encephalatus equatorialis. No juvenile plants. But there's, on this one hill where the species is found, there's a number of adult plants. But they're just not reproducing. And therefore, the species in the long term is probably doomed to dying out, unless there's some way of introducing those pollinators again, which has also got issues around it.
Fadi, how can people, if they want to follow you more, they want to stay in touch? I believe you have a newsletter as well.
Yes.
How can people get in touch with you?
Well, we've got a website, which is quite an easy. The URL is quite an easy one. It's called cycadsociety.org. And there's an email address on there, so they can contact us. We've got various branch managers, so our national secretary will just pass it on to the relevant branch manager. And then we try and assist people. What we do have is a magazine, which is called Encephalatus, and we get that out to the membership four times a year. What's important also, if you've got an interest in cycads, is to join the society, because I know in this world of the internet and talk shops and all these various things on the internet, the best way to still learn about something is to actually go to somebody's garden and see it for yourself.
For real, yeah.
And that's where the society comes in, you know.
They're beautiful plants.
Very beautiful and very diverse. Mm. We've got a lot of species in South Africa that have got blue foliage, and the reason for that is because they are drought tolerant. The blue comes from wax layers in the leaves. So we've got a cycad which is called the Karoo cycad, Encephalatus lemani. Brilliant blue plant because it's standing in the desert. You know, it needs to conserve water. What I also must just say is that not all cycads have got a high monetary value. So to give you an example, the guys sell, or you can market, buy plants at the centimeter price of the height of the stem or the diameter of the stem, whichever is largest. And the market for some species like Natalensis and Altensteini would be 30 rand a centimeter. But you could go totally to the other side of the extreme and pay 6,000 rand a centimeter for an Encephalitis hirsutus out of Venda. But these prices in general are decreasing because there's more plants in cultivation. And if there's more plants available, over time they become bigger. Mm. And, you know, their value actually drops, which is what we are trying to promote, is to rather be purchasing captive-produced seedlings and not to take plants out of the wild. But certain things are now so common in cultivation that it might actually – it's probably counterproductive for nature conservation to have these plants permitted because they just don't have the resources to manage the permitting for certain species. So we, at a national level, we are trying to negotiate that certain species actually be taken off the need for it to be permitted. Because it's easier for you to go down to a specialized nursery or to the society members. We've got a sale or a SICAD sale once a year, and go and purchase a few plants. What we also do is our members, we link them with each other. So if there's somebody that wants to sell some plants, we just put it on a distribution list. Okay. And the membership contacts each other. So
let me just remind listeners, if you want to get involved with the SICAD Society, www.sicadsociety.org. Ferdy Enderman, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having us.
With Cape Talk, WhatsApp us now on 072-567-1567.
20 minutes past 2 o'clock, we've been talking about cycads. A very good plant that's very resilient in the drought. And with the drought, and because it's Pippa's Planet, we can't not talk about water. I know that we've talked about it so much on the station, we can't talk about it enough, because only 34% of residents of the city are actually managing to stay below their 87 litres a day. Those level 6 water restrictions came into effect on the 1st of January. And I mentioned on the show earlier in the week that we had a burst water pipe in our road and watched water just flowing down the street. So I wanted to chat to Peter Flower, he's the city's director of water and sanitation, about what these level 6 restrictions and the changes in water pressure could potentially do to the pipe infrastructure, to the infrastructure around the city. Peter, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for your time.
Afternoon, Melanie, and afternoon to your listeners too.
Peter, I have to say, the leak was fixed relatively quickly, within a day or two. But how many teams are out there fixing leaks and responding to these calls on a daily basis?
Melanie, just to put it into perspective, there's very close to 11,000 kilometres of water reticulation pipelines in the city of Cape Town. So, you know, that is quite a massive infrastructure to maintain and keep operational. We've got a vast number of teams out there. To give you an exact figure right now is a bit tricky, but we incorporate a lot of contractors into the process as well. We've got the city divided up into a number of districts, and within each of those districts there are adequate resources to cope with the networks in those areas. We have a call centre to which people can forward their complaints, and it's handled through a system on our integrated computerized system for the city SAP, and notifications are raised, and they are tracked through the system at the various stages. So once they get onto that system, we can see exactly where each of those complaints is in the process of getting addressed. It's a massive undertaking, and we can deal with anything round about an average of about 800 to 850 notifications in a day. So that gives you maybe some sense of the scale of it.
Well, I mean, Cape Town does. It's got one of the most complicated infrastructure systems, I believe, in Africa, in fact.
Yeah, indeed. I think that's when one talks about that, one's talking more about the bulk system of supply for Cape Town and the region, from the system of dams that we utilize in conjunction with the National Department of Water and Sanitation. So that, that infrastructure reticulation, let's call it the bulk reticulation, is complex because it links these large dams together in such a way that the city is unable, through its bulk infrastructure, to maximize the yield of that total system. So we can put more load onto one of the dam subsystems through our treatment plants, where we see, for argument's sake, in wintertime when that dam is rising faster than the others, that we don't want it to overflow before any of the other dams because we would lose that water. So we put more demand onto that to reduce the rate at which that's filling. And conversely, in summertime, we can take load off a dam that we see is getting closer to a lower point that we, you know, that we can then put that load onto another system. So that enables that. Within the city's reticulation system, the network that feeds into our streets and to our houses, that too is complex, I guess. It's an integrated system, so we can supply pretty much to any point in the city from more than one of our bulk sources, which gives us the facility to always be able to reroute water from a different source if there is a problem in the infrastructure anyway. So our large outages are really reduced to almost zero, apart from obviously the local infrastructure outages when you have a burst main on your small distribution pipeline, when you have a, you know, a small area of a suburb possibly being down for a period until that burst is repaired. But your question about the response time, we work hard to keep that to a minimum because obviously when a pipe does burst or when there's a serious leak, that is a loss of water. And what we do there is we've introduced a new system over the last few years of, we call it first line or multi-line response. And what happens is the call comes in, it goes to our dispatch, and they then allocate the first line response that's nearest to that particular incident. They will go and identify the problem, look at what size pipe and what, you know, how big a job it is, isolate it, in other words, shut off the valves that are allowing the water to come out of that particular breach. And then if they're not able to, if it's just a small pipe, they could repair it themselves. If it's a larger one, they call in the appropriate size response team. So in that way, we can get quicker response to shutting it off, and then get an appropriate resource to that. So it cuts down on cost as well.
Just a reminder to listeners, we're talking to Peter Flower. He's the city's director of water and sanitation. If you have any comments, you can send a text or a voice note on 072-567-1567. Peter, level six, we're talking about intermittent supply. We're talking about reducing water pressure. What are the concerns about especially older pipes?
Right, well, thanks for raising that particular point. As a city, we have chosen not to go the route that other cities have gone, and where it's proven really to be not effective, and that is to shut off areas. The result of that is that you drain. As soon as you switch off the supply into an area, for argument's sake, a suburb, people continue drawing water, and slowly the pipe network drains of water, and what happens is it fills with air naturally. When you do switch it back on again by opening the valve to feed in, if you don't feed it in extremely slowly, you get pockets of air forming, and then they end up crashing together through the system, and you get an overpressure in places, which often results in a rupturing of the pipe. And as a result, you end up losing more water because of the burst than you had hoped to gain by shutting the area off. So we've chosen rather to go a route of, let's call it advanced pressure management. We have the facility through, over the years, we've been introducing areas where we can control the pressure and reduce it through pressure-reducing valves, which are also operated through a controller system. We can manage that either through a timing mechanism or a feedback loop from critical control points. And in this way, we can bring down pressure in the mains. Now, this, once the pressure in the pipeline is reduced, obviously it puts less stress or load onto that particular pipe. So, in effect, it could prolong the life of that pipe. But what it does, more importantly, in terms of what the main reason for doing it now is to reduce the loss. If there are any leaks, obviously if the pressure is lower, less water will leak out. And it has the impact of the user when he opens the tap, it will run at a slower rate. In other words, the flow will be lower, or the shower will run at a slower rate and so on. So that does result in a reduced consumption of water. So that is our aim, in fact, to rather than shut off, is to drop pressure down as much as possible. And we're continuing to advance that work across the whole network of the city. Now, that is quite vast, as I've mentioned earlier, so it's still in progress. And I think in the next weeks to come, people are going to start feeling it a lot more as we push these pressure management systems down to much lower levels.
Peter Flower, let me just bring Mashid in for a very quick question. We don't have much time left. Mashid phones in from Rondebosch. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Just a question. Water's not being shut off to particular areas, but people who have water management devices, when they use up their 350 or so liters of water for the day, water gets shut off. Air builds up, pipes are at risk. What happens there? If you're not doing it to an entire area, you're doing it to particular houses. If those houses then have burst water pipes, if it's internal or on the person's property, they then have to pay for that, which comes at a cost. Or if it's outside, then it comes at a cost to the city. So how do you manage that?
Peter?
Right. Look, what happens is that device will shut off at the meter. In fact, it replaces the meter, and it's a meter with a valve in it. And once the, as he rightly says, if you are set at 1,500 litres per month, which is the equivalent for an average four-person household of 87 litres per person per day, or 350 litres, what happens is after the 350 has been used, that valve shuts. That's not going to build up any pressure in the house, because as soon as you open a tap, you've equalized the pressure. In fact, it's that atmospheric pressure in that pipeline network that's within the house. So there's no danger of these devices causing any rupturing of internal plumbing in houses. All it does is stops the high-pressure water from the mains coming into your house. So we certainly don't recognize that as a risk to the plumbing of houses.